people don't, deep down, I think one of the biggest human tragedies in the world today is we don't believe in ourselves. We don't put a value in our own skin. So even though we might give back, we just don't want to see how we can impact the world. We it's like giving a beautiful woman a compliment or a good looking guy a compliment, and they kind of they take the little, what's those little things they swat a fly with? Something, they take a little fly swatter, excuse my language, if I'm plagiarizing. They swat the compliments that's coming toward. They don't want to hear it. They don't want to feel it. They certainly don't accept it, because they don't believe it. They think you're just saying it because it's not true. So I think that's number one. I think number two is people get so busy. They just create chaos, they create busyness, they create distractions to keep themselves from really becoming the version of themselves that they are, removing that mask and showing up and allowing the world to see how beautiful and magnificent they are.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Imagine if you could get some of the best insights from podcast guests on creativity, productivity, and what it takes to make your work unmistakable. Well, if you haven't picked it up yet, that's exactly what I did with my last book, Unmistakable: Why Only It Is Better Than Best. I put together all of the best insights combined with some of my own thoughts on what it takes to create work that's unmistakable. It might make a perfect stocking stuffer, and it might just inspire you to start that creative project you've been thinking about. And as always, today's episode is sponsored by our friends at HostGator. So if you've been thinking about this creative project, now is actually a really good time to start, since we're right around the corner from the end of the year. And if nothing else, just buy a domain name. The thing that I've found often is when you don't know what the next steps are, sometimes it's taking the first steps that reveals the rest. And our friends at HostGator are awesome for helping you get started, because they have 24/7 live support via phone chat and email, a super easy to use website builder if you're not tech savvy, and if you hate your current hosting provider and you want to switch, they make it easy and free. So visit hostgator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Philip, welcome back to the Unmistakable Creative.
Oh, welcome back. Thank you for having me. I'm actually a little bit more nervous today than previous ones, because when you're being honored, at least that's how I feel, to be invited back, it just feels like just an extra tad of pressure.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, you're easily one of our most popular guests of all time, you know, in the 7 years that we've done this, and for good reason, because our last few conversations have just been mind-blowing, so no pressure there at all. But I want to start a little bit differently than we did the last few times, because I know people are familiar with your work, and we'll link up the previous interviews in the show notes. But, you know, one of the things that you had mentioned to me when we last spoke was that you had a brother, and I have to give, you know, Brian, my business partner, credit for this question, because we've started it started a few episodes with this. So what birth order were you, and what impact has that had on your life and the choices that you've made?
Well, it's funny, you know, my answer to that is I'm the baby of the family. And I think even actually now that you've got me thinking about it, you know, saying I'm the baby of the family means that I, to some extent, haven't grown up. And the fact that to some extent, no matter how I grow up and how mature I believe I am, I'm always going to be immature in the context of my brothers. So it's interesting. It has had an impact. We were three very competitive boys. I always felt that I didn't have a voice. I felt that my voice didn't matter. And ironically, you asked that question, Srini, because one of the things I yearned for, and I'm sharing something very personal here, yearned deeply, was for my brothers to really see and hear me. And the way I contextualized that, right or wrong, was the day that they would come and ask me for advice, you know, quote unquote. And I held off and waited for that day desperately, yearning for them to see the value that I potentially have in this world. And it never really came. And I eventually just let it go. And I mean, really emotionally, deep down, let it go. And I said, I don't need their validation. And it most likely will never come. Mm-hmm. And ironically, within the last 12 months, both my brothers took me aside and asked me specific advice about two areas of their lives. And I was incredibly humble, incredibly grateful. And it definitely released me from this old need, if you like. And I don't know what if that's relevant, but that's just what came up for me right now.
Okay, so two things you said there. One was that you felt that you didn't have a voice. And I think that there are probably a lot of people who have felt that. And I'm wondering, you know, what do you say to those people who feel that? The other is this idea of letting go of validation. So, you know, I wrote about this in my book, and it's something that is very near and dear to me personally, because it's something I wrestle with still. And I'm curious how you finally let go of validation, how other people let go of their need for validation in their lives.
I think we honor it. I don't think we try to run away from it. I don't think we try to let go of it. I think when you honor it, I think by honoring it, let go. So, for example, you just use the context of the conversation I just shared with you about my brothers. And I've never shared this publicly before outside of a very small private group that I work with in a coaching capacity. I've never shared this publicly.
I've been known to do that to people.
Yeah, well, you know, and that's why you're so gifted at what you do. And I've said this to you many times before that, you know, I always feel deeply honored on your show. I just feel you create this beautiful space. And anyway, I just, you know, I think you're just very, very good at what you do.
Thanks.
You know, in terms of I think, you know, rather than realizing and identifying I need their validation and then running from it and then waking up someday and intellectually telling myself, oh, I don't need it anymore. For God's sake, I'm 40 years old. Of course I don't need it. And thinking that it's gone, but yet emotionally it's still playing out. What I did was I stopped and I leaned directly into that conversation. I said, okay, why do you need this? And what does it even look like? Because often we want something, but we don't even know how it looks like. And yet we continue to yearn for it for years. And I actually literally played it out, almost role played it. And I started to be compassionate about it rather than saying things like, oh, for God's sake, you're so pathetic. You're 40 years old and you're looking for your brothers to ring you and ask you for advice. Get over yourself. You see how judgmental that is? And that's just suppressed. It's not honoring it. And then what I did is I just created this space from a place of compassion and said, you know what? That's what you want. So be it. Great. But you know what? It may not come. And you know what? Maybe you just need to let it go. And of course, ironically, the very time you do that is the very time it comes back. So I think part of the letting go is honoring it as opposed to pretending it doesn't exist or not wanting it to exist. Honor the conversation. And I think it lets go of its grip on you.
So this might be a bit personal, but what was the advice that they asked for? And what was the advice that you gave them?
Yeah, it is. It is a bit. And I would share anything about my personal life.
Sure, fair enough. But
when it comes to like personal clients or people who have asked me advice, I am incredibly protective. All I will say is this: one was about business, mm-hmm. You know, my brother, and the other one was about in the context of a relationship. And I'm a very like I would love to share the details, but I just think it would be dishonor, and particularly the fact that it was their first time coming to me. If I use that information to enhance this interview. Or try to while the intent is good, I think it might hurt and dishonor them, and therefore I'd rather not get into the details if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, I completely appreciate that. So, one other question from that was, you know, people who feel that they don't have a voice, what do you say to them?
Well, I mean, the obvious thing is that, well, of course you do. And, but the reality is that, you know, many people have probably told them that, and they probably even told themselves that. But at some level, they still feel deep down that they don't have a voice. So it's like a positive affirmations. If I had 1 million people who lined up and we got one of your listeners who struggles with not finding their voice, which I'm absolutely sure there's many. And finding your voice is not speaking on a stage. Finding your voice is not doing a podcast necessarily. Finding your voice is not writing a book. Finding your voice is just trusting yourself to speak your truth at home, behind closed doors, as well as being on the street. And honoring yourself so you don't feel you're suppressing a part of who you are. Typically, we do that. We don't honor our voice for a number of different reasons. Number one is maybe we haven't been schooled to do that. And what I mean by school is I don't mean traditional education. I mean the school of life. Maybe we're brought up to suppress our emotions, to hide a part of who we are, to cry when the doors are closed. So our parents sometimes have not necessarily been the greatest attributes of encouraging this spoken truth, which, by the way, I believe is our emotion. It's how we feel. Our truth is how we feel, not what we think. So I think, you know, that's played an impact. You know, sometimes we just don't have the confidence. We don't think that the world sees our truth as valuable. And I would encourage you to look at, rather than looking at ways to improve it, to find your voice, to bring it from a whisper to a roar, that's one strategy. But I'd rather you say, well, why isn't it there? Why do I not trust my truth? Why do I feel I don't have a voice? Why does the world not see and hear me when I speak? What is that really about? And again, do a deeper dive into that conversation. And then I would coming out of that, I wouldn't wait and put your life on pause till you figure it all out. Mm. I would find ways. I mean, I do a thing called One Last Talk, which you've been at. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a great example of putting people on a stage who have never shared, in some cases, ever spoken publicly, and they share part of their truth. And it's staggering. not just how it can potentially impact the audience, but how it ultimately shifts their perspective on their story. So share a part of your truth in a safe environment where you may not be judged, and start to get comfortable with sharing parts of your story that perhaps you haven't shared before. And see that maybe you're doing it not for you, you're doing it to help other people, that your story is not about you. Your story has the impact and the potential to actually, you know, to move the needle for other people. Stop making the journey about you. That's probably my biggest challenge or invitation to people in the context of their story.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to hear you talk about how we suppress, you know, our truth around certain people. And I know that I've seen myself do it in situations where I'm thinking, okay, I want to impress this person, I shouldn't say this. And it kind of takes us back to that whole idea of validation. Like I've seen myself do it, but particularly in the context of intimate relationships.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, the story I share, you know, just it's a little anecdotal story, but I think it's a wonderful expression or example of this is there's a lady I did some work with, and she ended up going on a blind date. And she found herself at home putting on makeup that she wouldn't ordinarily wear, or an amount of it that typically was uncomfortable for her, wearing shoes or high heels that she hadn't worn in years, and kind of sprucing herself up, but in a way that wasn't in alignment with who she started to uncover was her real authentic self, so to speak. She goes to this date, and very quickly, within the first 10 minutes, they establish that really there's no connection, and that rather than waste the opportunity of the meal, they said, well, why don't we just have dinner and just connect? And as it turns out, they got to this conversation, well, what do you look for in a man, or what do you look for in a woman? And the guy said, well, no disrespect, it's not a judgment. I just love women who are comfortable without makeup and women who don't feel the need to doll themselves up. And she's looking at this guy going, oh my God, holy shit, this is exactly, I'm dressed up exactly in the way that I'm not meant, like this is not me. So what we do is when we walk out into the world, we wear masks, we wear makeup, we wear clothes, we wear whatever, not because we're comfortable always, but because we want to fit in, we want to be seen, we want to be liked. And that really speaks to a deep insecurity within the context of our own skin that perhaps we've never addressed. And that to me is, when you address that, you don't need external validation from your brothers, your wives, your cousins, or your neighbors for that matter.
So, you know, one of the things that's interesting to me is that I know you have kids, I know you're married, and I'm curious, you know, given the work that you do and the fact that you spend so much time helping adults make change in their lives, how has that impacted the way you raise kids? And what would you say to parents who are listening?
I was asked, I spoke on a stage in Toronto. I did a keynote speech, and I only had time for one question at the end. We did a lot of interaction, but I only took one formal question. And this gentleman said, he said, have you got advice on parenting? And I jokingly said, well, let's start with an easy one. And of course, everyone laughs and I said, you know, Jesus, what a big subject. And I paused, and not because I was thinking, I was actually pausing and I was actually filtering whether, and I tend not to do that. I was filtering whether what I was about to share, what was in my heart was appropriate and how it would be judged. And I said it anyway. And I looked at this man in front of 700 people and I said, no matter what you do as a parent, you're going to fuck your kids up. And he completely kind of fell apart. The audience fell apart. Most of them, some of them were absolutely outraged and disgusted by what I had just said, and maybe jumped to conclusions. And I said, guys, before you judge me, allow me to explain. Number one is, did I need to use an F-bomb? No. But does using an F-bomb make it a little bit more dramatic? And I don't mean for effect. I mean in terms of it jarring us emotionally. But really my bigger invitation and perspective was to say, no matter what you do as a parent, you're going to mess your kids up. So what I'm asking you to do is not give up on them. It's not a case of, well, sure, gee, if that's the case, McKernan, I'm just going to give up. It's not. But what I'm asking people to do is to let go and to know that no matter how perfect their life is, no matter how they parent a child, no matter how amazing they think they are, that their kids are going to find nuances and aspects of how they were parented that are going to come back and going to bite them in the ass. So what it does is it gives you freedom. It gives you this like, okay, I'm going to mess my kids up. I'll do my best, but I'm not going to try and be the best. So you take the pressure off. That's number one. Number two is, and here's the biggest point I believe, is, you know, be the, you know, as Gandhi said, be the change, but like be the person that you want them to be. And I don't mean that, do it, fake it. I mean, organically. So the example I use is, let's just say the parent themselves is in a situation where they're misaligned. They're misaligned with the work they do. They're misaligned in the relationship with themselves. They're misaligned with the relationship externally. and they're struggling and they're justifying and rationalizing staying in that job or business that they don't like because they're doing it for their kids. Now, with respect, I don't think that's fair to your children because your children didn't ask for that. They didn't come into this world and say, hey, dad, hey, mom, use me as a reason not to make a change and live your dreams. And here's what happens. If I ask a parent, say, okay, let's just say fast forward and your little son, Johnny, comes to you with the same predicament and says, I'm misaligned, I'm not happy, what would you say to them? Most parents would say, change, do something, live your dreams, don't settle. You're worth more than that. The world needs you, whatever those things are. And my question is, well, why aren't you doing that? Oh, well, it's different for me. It's different. I need to put the kids through college. I need to do this. I need to do that. And here's what happens. In 25 years from now, if that conversation ever happens, it is a lecture. And that son, Johnny, who's now 25 years older, is either externally or internally rolling his eyes to heaven because he's basically saying, Dad, I hear what you're saying. Thanks, Mom, for the advice. But you know what? You guys didn't do it. If you live your dream, if you move towards what is an authentic expression of yourself, if you uncover, not find, because you already have it, the courage to make changes, to move, to be almost selfish in that advance, and don't live your life through the lens of your children. And what will happen is you'll inspire your kids by osmosis, by proximity. You'll inspire their soul to believe that they're worth more. So when they hit a wall in 25 years, they'll go, my dad had the courage. My mother had the courage to say no and to change it. And I'm going to do the same.
Hmm. Wow. Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears and get into why you're really here. So, you know, I know people who follow you in Facebook already have probably seen it. You have recently finished work on a documentary film, and I can only imagine the work is amazing. But I'd like to start with kind of, you know, how the seed got planted for doing something like this, because really, you know, you're known for speaking and coaching. You're not necessarily known as a filmmaker. And I personally think labels limit your capacity. So I think it's awesome that you're doing this. But I'd love to talk about, you know, sort of where the seed got planted for this.
Yeah. And I think you've just touched on something very beautiful. And the way you said it is so poetic, is that the seed, you know, so many people are limited by the labels they put on themselves, the stories they've been told. And I'm one of these people that I want to become a human disruptor. I want to disrupt the conversation. And if I have to be the guy to take the lead in some area to prove that you can be a filmmaker, you can write a book despite being dyslexic, you can speak on a stage despite the fact that you had horrendous low confidence or whatever, if I can be the catalyst to help somebody realize that they can do the same thing, well, I'm willing to put in the work to do that. You know, Serini, that, you know, the actual seed, I mean, I've always been a fan of films and even documentaries to some extent, but never imagined, I mean, even as you say filmmaker, it feels kind of weird, ever imagined that I'd be that person, that I could achieve something to that extent. And number one, as I say, I mean, we're very clear here, I put a team together and the team really, you know, facilitated and processed this as well. I know I couldn't have done it on my own. At the same time, it does take somebody that has the vision and has the courage to put their hand up and say, I'm going to do this. So about 2.5, I'm guessing about 2.5 years ago, I had a gentleman who came in and spoke to one of my small coaching programs at the time, a guy called James, who is the filmmaker for Food Matters and Hungry for Change. And James came in and was very gracious with his time. We'd met before I was on stage and he'd heard me speak. And he's gone on to make a number of films and make an impact in the world. And he just came in his very low-key, very unassuming, very passionate, very engaging way, just shared his journey. And in that moment, it was just like, shit, why not? Why couldn't I be a filmmaker? Now, I didn't have a plan. I didn't have the story. And then Give and Grow, which is very close to my heart, is this old message that we have just kind of reintroduced to the world to some extent, was floating around. And I said, well, what would it be like to bring a film crew to India a year and a bit ago? And that was the beginning of it. And it was 2.5 years ago, the idea was placed, or the seed was set. And then about 12 months ago, we pulled the trigger, and we will have turned around a full feature length documentary within a space of 12 months when it's launched in the next 2 or 3 weeks.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Design Crowd. So maybe the whole idea of design intimidates you, but it doesn't have to, because that's where a service like Design Crowd comes in. because they make the equivalent of an entire creative team accessible to you at a price that's incredibly affordable. In fact, if you go to designcrowd.com/creative, you can actually see what other Unmistakable Creative listeners have had made. They've had business cards made, logos, flyers, all sorts of stuff. Here's how it works. You go to designcrowd.com and you submit your design brief. Then you'll get submissions from anywhere between 60 to 100 designers from around the world. If you like what you get, then you can approve payment, or you can go back to the crowd and ask for more, or ask for your money back. And because you're an Unmistakable Creative listener, you're getting $100 off your first design project. So visit designcrowd.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for $100 off. Today's episode is also sponsored by our friends at HostGator. So let's say that you've had a website design and you have no idea where to host that website. Well, that's where our friends at HostGator come in. They have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email, an easy-to-use website builder if you're not tech-savvy, and if you want to switch hosting providers from the one that you're currently at, they make the whole process free and seamless. So visit hostgator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off all of their hosting packages. Wow. So before we hit record, you were telling me about a day in Sri Lanka at an orphanage that really kind of was one of those moments of inspiration for this. I'd love for you to tell us a bit about that in a bit more detail.
Yeah, I think it's probably one of the most, there's not many, there's probably only about three or four real pivotal moments in my life. And one was when I went to Sri Lanka a year after the tsunami had hit. And rather than, allow myself to sit in the 5-star hotel on Christmas Day, I said to my wife, I cannot, or actually it was Christmas Eve. I said, I feel really uncomfortable. And Christmas morning, I went for a walk on the beach. And I remember just these turtles. I don't know what the significance of the turtles were, quite frankly, but I remember the stirring in the water. I walk into the ocean fully clothed, and these massive turtles were just under the surface, three of them. And they just far two or three of them. They floated just around me. I came out of the water, looked my wife in the eyes, and I said, I have to leave this hotel. And we just drove, and we found ourselves in this remote area, you know, walking into a little B&B and meeting a lady. Because I wanted to give back. I had this yearning, screaming that I needed to give back, that there was something more important on this island than me having a holiday. And I met this lady who ironically was going to an orphanage on the day of the one-year anniversary of the tsunami. And I went with her. And that was just so pivotal and huge for me. Because what it did was, when I came back from that experience, the biggest thing was not just that I enjoy spending time with the kids, but something shifted inside me. And I said, really, I'd love to tell you, I got it at the time, but it was kind of just this feeling that I couldn't put my finger on, that something had shifted. And really what happened was my value shifted. I started to feel, not think, that actually maybe you're here for a bigger reason, McKernan. That was number one. And number two is, when I came back, everyone was hungover. Everyone was dying, eating too much, dreading going back to work. And that would have been me and was me. And for the first time I looked and said, I don't have to do this. I don't have to go to work to a job that's not thrilling me. I don't have to drink too much alcohol and just be hungover. It gave me choices. And it's just like taking off a set of glasses and putting on a new set that just had a different lens. And that was pivotal in me beginning the idea of moving to Canada. And it was about 12 or 14 or 18 months later, we moved from Ireland, the place I love, and kind of started to reinvent, or maybe find, who I really was in this world and my place in this world and what I was here to do.
So I've asked numerous people why people miss pivotal moments, but I am actually much more interested in something else with you. Why do you think most people don't, or so many people don't, do anything in those pivotal moments?
I think they don't create the space. So when I look at, well, let's just personalize it to this volunteering, if you like, or working in orphanages. There's many people that have worked in orphanages and whatever, and they haven't come back and they haven't made change. They've gone and worked at the homeless people. They've gone to soup kitchens, homeless shelters. They've gone to their neighbors. They've helped people. They haven't made a change. I think there's a number of different things. Number one is, I think people don't, deep down, I think one of the biggest human tragedies in the world today is we don't believe in ourselves. We don't put a value in our own skin. So even though we might give back, we just don't want to see how we can impact the world. We it's like giving a beautiful woman a compliment or a good looking guy a compliment, and they take the little, what's those little things they swat a fly with? Something, they take a little fly swatter, excuse my language if I'm plagiarizing. They swat the compliments that's coming toward. They don't want to hear it. They don't want to feel it. They certainly don't accept it, because they don't believe it. They think you're just saying it because it's not true. So I think that's number one. I think number two is, people get so busy. they just create chaos, they create busyness, they create distractions to keep themselves from really becoming the version of themselves that they are, removing that mask and showing up and allowing the world to see how beautiful and magnificent they are. There are two kind of reasons, if you like, or two things that happen. But the other thing is that sometimes, and this is what was frustrating me. I don't mean that going and volunteering doesn't work, but here's the missing link in 99.9%, if not all, volunteer experiences. You go, you volunteer, you feel good, hopefully. You go home and you may make a change, but you're not sure what just happened. So what I created was this concept where we would go and give back. Then we would create space in nature, and then we would process. Okay, so it's very simple questions, but we would go deeper around and say, okay, what happened for you this week? What child spoke to you? What moved you emotionally? Why did it move you emotionally? How does this relate to your life? How does this relate in the context of your gift, not your talent? Where does your gift play into this? And ultimately start to move towards the space of what are you going to do as a result of this beautiful, you know, this incredible experience of giving, because the giving doesn't just help other people. It unlocks us. It changes us. But the thing is, we don't necessarily process that. So what would happen with India, we process this. And what you find is people before, during, and afterwards, and some of the changes these people made, leaving cities they didn't like, changing businesses that they weren't particularly aligned to, leaving jobs they hated, and just becoming better leaders in not such society, but in the context of their own businesses. So to me, the processing, why did this move you emotionally? That's missing from a lot of the societal conversation.
So I want to talk really more in depth about this idea of giving. You know, you mentioned, you said a phrase to me when we first started speaking and before we hit record about this idea that giving unconditionally causes us to grow exponentially, which I just absolutely loved. So I want to talk about sort of what you meant by that, look at it in detail. And I know you also mentioned as part of the film, you work with neuroscientists to kind of look at how does this impact people on a brain level. So I'm curious about all of those things.
Yeah. So there's a lot of giving going on in the world today, and it's great. And even if a corporation gives, you know, $2.4 million a year and it's purely for marketing, does the $2.5 million make an impact in the world? Of course it does. So it's not a judgment space. And there's a lot of people are giving through the lens of writing checks. And I myself have raised money in the last 12 months to build an orphanage. So I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I just think it's limited. I know it doesn't have the capacity to move the needle for us emotionally in the same way that actually putting ourselves in the trenches, putting ourselves in the fire line of actually giving of ourselves unconditionally without using any materialistic item like pencils or shoes or clothing or even money for that matter in the way. We've become a society that when it comes to giving, a lot of us look at giving through the lens of money. And what I'm suggesting is that what we do is we bring people away in these trips and said, you don't give money, you don't give gifts, you give yourself. And they're going, what does that mean? What does that look like? And of course, you can't really describe it and experience until you're there. No language. So phrase books are not allowed. And I don't mean not allowed. You can bring a phrase book, but I encourage people not to. And to watch people just sit down with a young child, and the young child, all they want, and we've specialized in working with kids and orphans and street kids, all they want is they just want to be seen. They want to feel. They want to know that you care about them, that they matter, even for a minute, even for a day, even for like a week. And it's extraordinary what happens. And here's what I believe happens. When you see them for who they are and you allow yourself, you give yourself the courage to be vulnerable and allow your guard down and allow your insecurities about not getting emotional, not having a phrase book, not having a toy in your hand, what happens is they see you too. And they see right into your soul and you're accepted and seen sometimes in a way that you have never been seen before. And it shifts you. It just shifts who you are. So when we give, a lot of the time we have this, we give, you know, we do have some conditions. We expect something in return. We expect when we bring a pie to our neighbor that in some way they'll bring a pie back, or they'll bring a bottle of wine back, or they'll do the snow on our driveway, or they'll shut their dog up from barking. We sometimes give and we have some sort of residual expectation of what we get in return. And if we can let go of that, give unconditionally of ourselves, the growth that's available for us is, I can't put words on it. All I know is what it's done for me and what it's done for clients that I serve. It's huge.
I'm very curious. What did What did these kids teach you about yourself, and what did they teach the people that came on this trip with you? Like, what did people learn about themselves from these kids?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. I think what they do is that they if let's just purely make this self like personally about the individual who goes to help and to give back. I think you learn about yourself, not just intellectually, but I think you really get to know yourself on a very deep emotional sense, a really wonderful sense of awareness. So I'll give you an example of this to try and contextualize it. I had one lady who came on a trip, and at the end of it, we do this workshop. And I just asked a very simple question. I said, what child spoke to you? What child really spoke to you? And I don't mean physically spoke to you, but what one that stood out? What one were you emotionally drawn to? And so they start identifying that. They see parts of themselves in these kids. And then they start to go, wow, I never would have joined that dot on my own. And then another question I asked just to follow up on that is, what did you bring to these children? And I remember one lady sitting to my right. She's 5 foot nothing. She's this tiny little lady, but she's got a heart as big as a rhino. And she's sitting next to me, and I said, what do you mean, like toys? And I said, no, what did you bring? What part of your soul, your personality, like part of your essence did you bring? And she couldn't come up with anything. And yet she literally was the epitome of giving in this group. Like, everyone was amazed of how she gave so unconditionally. The only thing she didn't do was cut her vein and pour her blood on the table. Literally. I mean, that she gave everything. And she couldn't identify it. And eventually she got so uncomfortable. I said, right, guys, everyone put your pens down. I said, this lady cannot identify one thing that she brought to the children outside of materialistic items. Let's help her out. What did you see that she brought to these children? And one guy raises his hand and says, how many hours have we got for this exercise? And she just started crying. This is a woman who has such a heart, who is a wonderful mother, has given so much to her children, who supports her husband beyond belief, and she cannot recognize her own value on this earth. If it happens in Guatemala in an orphanage, trust me, it happens in her home every single day. And the guys and the girls fed back your personality, your sense of humor, your just your willingness to give unconditionally. And she's literally there, tears rolling down her face. So she said to me afterwards, that's the greatest gift I have ever been giving. Just to realize that I have value beyond belief. And she just never would have seen that before unless we took the time to have and to do that exercise.
So I guess the other question is, what are the lives of these kids in orphanages like? And what do we, what misperceptions do we have? And what do we not know? Like, what are we not seeing about the reality of this situation?
Well, I think that's another wonderful question. I mean, I had one lady who said, oh, you know, I really want to go on one of these retreats, this Give and Grow retreat. But she said, you know, what happens when you leave the kids? And I said, what do you mean? She goes, well, I'll be so upset. And I said, well, number one is you don't know. And number two is you're making it all about you. She goes, what do you mean? I said, this is all about you right now. You're not going to give the kids. You're here and you want to make sure that you're safe and that you don't cry and you're not vulnerable and you're not upset. And I said, quite frankly, if that's the case, I understand why you would do that, because I would have done that. But quite frankly, then it's probably not a fit. And she goes, okay. So she got over that. She came and as she left the kid, she goes, oh my God, with a smile right across her face. Was there a bit of sadness? Yeah. But the joy, the overwhelming joy. So we have this massive misconception about what it is like to go and work with orphans and street kids in these different places around the world. Massive misconception. We think we're going to help them out, to save them from the world. And we go thinking that our heart's going to be ripped apart when we leave there. And I'm telling you right now, it is the absolute opposite of that. You have no idea what you're going to get. And again, that's not why we do it. So you'll end up getting way more than you could ever even fathom, number one. Number two is the one thing that's overridingly obvious is when you get to these places is not that they're perfectly happy. And people just tell you, oh, people in the third world and undeveloped countries, they're all way happier than us. I'm not sure it's as simple as that. But there is a happiness in amongst this disorder, this pain, this emptiness. There's this happiness and this joy that's genuine. It's not put on. It's not they're pretending to be happy on Facebook every day like some people. They're not putting their best foot forward. You see what you get, and you get what you see, and you feel them. And they don't have all of the – they don't wear masks. And the simplicity of their life, they don't have stuff. And one little example that's in the documentary is a lady who came from Canada. She came on this trip. And she's there to help the kids, again, help, quote unquote. And this girl comes over and could see that she was so uncomfortable, not just in the orphanage, but in her life. She took her by the hand. She brought her upstairs to show her her little dorm area where she lived with 20 other kids and her life's possessions. And this little girl gave her her earrings as a gift. This orphan girl who has almost nothing wanted to give her a gift and gave one of my, I wouldn't call her a client, a friend, a clan, one of our members. She gave her her earrings to acknowledge her and say, thank you for coming to visit us. We have this such a misconception about what is going on in these places. And we also think that in order to help, we need to raise money. We need to buy a washing machine. We need to do this. The kids need to be seen. They need to know that someone cares about them, that they have value in this world. And that is the greatest thing that we can do for these children.
So, you know, we've spent a lot of time talking about how the people who come to this change, I'm very interested in how the kids change as a byproduct of the work that you guys do there.
Yeah, I mean, some of it I have to speculate a little bit and hope, sure. But I can tell you one thing. I can show you actual photographs of literally photographs of a child or children as we come to the orphanage and how they're so standoffish and how they're so they want to be close, but they're guarded because they don't want to be let down. They don't want to be abandoned. They don't want to be this. They don't want to be that. And literally show you photographs of those kids a day later, 2 days later, 3 days later, literally buried into a conversation, buried into a hug, and literally buried in and knowing that they're safe. And the consistent feedback we get from every single project we've ever went to is that our groups are different than any other group that has ever come through the door. Other Christian groups coming through the door, they're there because they want to give Bibles. I'm not saying they don't care about the kids, and there's not some groups that don't have a genuine desire to give unconditionally. But a lot of the giving is the other thing they cannot stand. These young kids cannot stand is tourists coming in, doing the orphanage thing, tick, yeah, did that, take some photographs, and then leave. They know the difference. Kids, you can't bullshit a kid. They know the difference between someone who's giving unconditionally and truly wants to be there, as opposed to people who think they should be there and have to do the orphanage thing, are there with a condition that you must read my Bible and believe in what I say before I contribute to you. So that's a lot of conditional giving. We've literally had kids say to us that this group is different than any other group we've ever had. We went to one organization, for example, and it was mentally challenged, disabled. I can sometimes get mixed up and trying to be over politically correct. And my question to the owner, the organizer, they had no outdoor place to play in Sereni. And I said, how often do they go out? He said, well, they haven't. That girl's been out. She was out last week. And I said, no, I'm talking about the whole orphanage. How often they've never been out together. I said, they've never been outside together. I said, no. They're too mentally challenged. They're too physically challenged. And I said, excuse my language. I said, fuck that. And I said, we're bringing them out now. And she goes, no, you can't do that. And I said, watch me. And we got everyone together, and every one of our clients, our clan, took one of the children. In some cases, they were so physically challenged, two people had to take them. And we brought them down the road to a park. It's very emotional, like rethinking and remembering this, but it was so beautiful. We literally had people beeping the horn, shouting out the windows at us. And I thought they were giving out to us for being in the middle of the road. They were saying thank you. These were the locals who knew these kids were left in this room, left in this building, and they'd never been taken outside ever before. And we had the locals thanking us for doing it. And the joy in these kids' lives, like in their faces, maybe I'm in complete denial, but I feel to my soul that even that one day where someone gave them the freedom, who said, you're not so messed up or so unwelcomed in society that you can't come outside the door with us, to know that they are more than welcome, that they deserve to be out in a playground like everybody else. I can't, and no one will convince me otherwise. I've seen it in their eyes, the shift it makes in those people.
Wow. So I'm very curious, you know, what you learned from sort of a neuroscience and brain science perspective about the kinds of changes this causes in the brain, given that you've had a neuroscience researcher in the film.
Yeah, you're going to be maybe surprised, maybe not surprised, and maybe this will frustrate the shit out of people. Honestly, and I would say this with the greatest respect in the world to Mark, who came in and gave his expertise. And this might sound so bad, but I invited Mark in because I wanted to make sure that the skeptics didn't just shut out the message and say, hey, this is just all woo-woo fluffy bullshit.
Yeah.
Honestly, Sereni, I don't even know. What he says, I respect fully. And he comes at it from a very clinical, very research-based, very scientific perspective. What I'll tell you this is for certain. He absolutely 100% backs up and validates every single thing that we believe. Excuse me. He talks about the difference between giving money and actually being in the trenches and giving back personally. The details, I don't know. And not that it doesn't matter to me, but it doesn't matter to me. Because no one can replace, I don't care what science says, when you're in front of a child, you're in an orphanage and are holding those kids' hand, looking into their eyes, when you see that shift emotionally, when you work with a client who comes back after being in India with us and looks me in the eyes and said, McKernan, if nothing else, that trip, that giving, I cannot lie to myself anymore. I have to make changes in my life to bring more meaning and alignment into my life. That's all I need. I don't need the science to prove it. The reason we brought Mark in, and I'm very glad we did, is to illustrate to the skeptics, the very heady people who need the research, that's why we brought him in. In terms of the details of what we got from that, I can't even explain it. I'd rather let people watch the film or look it up in Google or whatever when you give scientifically, unconditionally, how it helps you grow and see your life differently. I think they can find that information pretty straightforward.
Okay, so we've talked quite a bit about a lot of the changes and sort of experiences that people had. I'm really now very curious about the creative process for putting something like a film together. Like, what is involved from a creative side of all of this? Like, because, you know, it doesn't seem as simple as going and shooting footage. And I know from what I'm told about documentaries, you shoot like hundreds of hours of footage for 2 minutes that make it into a film.
Yeah. 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 So sorry, I'm just a bit rattled because I mean, I didn't expect to cry here. So you've achieved one thing today. I feel like I'm in the film Jerry Maguire and I'm saying I will not cry, but yet I do. Excuse me. So for me, the advice that I got was categorically, you must figure out your distribution first and work from the distribution back into the distribution channel and work back in there for the film and the story and there for the team that you put around it. So it's basically coming out, you know, coming up with the outcome and then working backwards. And while I knew nothing about filmmaking at the time, I chose not to take that advice despite my intellect saying that's the way to do it. Because I felt that if I did that, it would distort the message. It would distort the story, that I would create the film in a different way, the message in a different way, that it would sell and it would be more marketable and I wouldn't necessarily honor the same message. So I said, I'm not going to do that. And I went against my intellect. I followed my gut and I said, no, I'm going to create a film that I believe the world needs to hear and I'll figure out the distribution afterwards. And a lot of people would say that that's crazy, but that's the way I approached it. So the creative process is very much being with the story that I feel the world needs to hear, but not being over attached to it. And what I mean by that is, as we headed out into India and we started to film, we had one kind of intention, but without being overly attached to it. And what ended up coming, this story of giving unconditionally and growing exponentially, was the backbone of the filming, the interviews, the conversations that we had. Excuse me, sorry. But what ended up emerging from the film really was, it's actually all about our gifts. It's all about uncovering, understanding and unleashing our gifts on the world are not as the case for some people. So the story took a little bit of a twist in amongst the giving unconditionally, the emergence of this gift. And I honestly believe if I was too attached to the outcome in terms of the storyline, or I had manufactured the distribution work backwards, we would have missed that subtlety, which I believe is the most significant part of the film right now. So that's the creative side of it. The actual structural side of it, probably the best thing I did was I put a director in place. I removed myself from being the guy, from an egotistical and an operational standpoint, being the guy that had to own and run everything. I put a filmmaker in place, a director in place who basically had made films before. I put a co-director in place. I put a producer in place. And I removed myself a lot from the day-to-day stuff. And that's the two big things that I did, which probably, I believe, created the biggest impact in this film.
Wow. Wow. So one last question about this. You know, you mentioned that you detached from outcomes, and you know, you and I talked briefly about detaching from outcomes before, and this is something very personal to me at the moment because it's something that I had to learn how to deal with in the process of putting a book out into the world that didn't meet the expectations I originally had for it. So I'm curious, you know, when you're looking at creative projects of any kind, how do you develop the mindset that allows you to detach from outcomes and ultimately allows the work to become what it's destined to be?
Yeah, to me, my focal point is less about distribution, less about sales, less about Facebook likes, less about numbers of books or films or anything else. To me, it's about why am I doing the message? Like, what's the why behind the project? And for me, it's you know, I have this way of detaching and saying it's not about me, it's about the people I'm trying to serve, the message I'm trying to get off. So when I move into those insecure places and those fear-based places where I go, shit, what if no one watches the film? What if no one comes? What if it's play, like, what if people rip it apart and say it's shit? What if my grandmother's the only person that buys the film, et cetera, et cetera? If I go into those paranoid, worried places where it's very much from a place of my mind and my brain, I bring myself back in saying, hang on a second, we've already achieved an outstanding goal with this film. And I'll give you an example. The rough cut, for those of you maybe listening who don't understand filmmaking, you trust me, I was part of this process. The rough cut is basically literally what it says. It's a rough cut. So it's basically as the film is being pieced together, it's not beautifully edited, there's no music, it's just a rough cut. So it's basically your first version of your film without the editing happening, same as a book in some ways. And Matt, who's part of our team, basically played it and allowed his mother to watch it just to get a bit of a finger in the pulse. His mother said, well, apart from crying in various parts in the film, I literally stopped watching the film and I went online and researched where to volunteer in my own community. And Matt is sharing this and I'm literally, there's tears in my eyes. This is the rough cut. So we've already achieved, I believe, something magnificent. Not that Matt's mother's not a good person, but Matt's mother has never been the type of person that would volunteer outside of her own family, outside of her own environment. And if nothing else, we've got one person to go out into the world and start to volunteer. And who knows where that'll go. So to me, I'm always, always, always with the people that this message is serving and the kids we're trying to and the people that we've served when we're in India in this particular project. Making sure that they're honored, that we're not using them to sell a film, we're not using them to sell some promotional thing, that we're honoring their existence, we're honoring their pain. And there has to be a purpose in the pain in this world. And to find the pain, to deliver it hopefully in a respectful way, and I can't decide that your listeners, any of those who ever watch the film, will be the deciders of this, is that hopefully we've honored the discomfort and the pain and the challenges these people have. And that's how I focus on it. And after that, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm so out to lunch. Maybe I should be focused on the commercial reality, you know, how to market the shit out of this thing, how to do this. And it's not my style.
Wow. Well, this has been amazing. So first off, where can people learn more about the film?
giveandgrow.com. So basically they can watch the trailer there. If they like what they see, great. If they don't, so be it. And then the film will be out in I'm guessing within the next number of weeks, and we're excited and very nervous at the same time, and hopefully it's received reasonably well.
Awesome. Well, I want to finish with my last question, which is funny because you're the one person that I've probably asked this question to three times in a very short period of time. So I'm very curious to see if your answer will change, which means I'll have to go back and listen to the previous ones. But what do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think what makes people unmistakable is their truth. If they've got the courage to speak their truth, find their voice. And I think in a world, unfortunately, that conspires and really desperately wants us to be in line and to pull the line and to be similar and be more robotic, I think what makes somebody unmistakable is if they can uncover the courage just to speak their truth every day and to take the masks off and be themselves, not anybody else, just be themselves. And I don't think there's anything more unbelievable or unmistakable about a person who just is comfortable in their own skin. It's very beautiful, it's very attractive, and it's more of what the world needs.
Well, I'm really, really thrilled to have had you back here on The Unmistakable Creative for a third time, and really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share more of your story and your insights with our listeners.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Next time on The Unmistakable Creative.
You meet certain people and you kind of fall into certain things. And I really do kind of believe in that argument that meaning emerges from mastery rather than the other way around. You know, that you kind of become passionate about something through the process of, you know, kind of pursuing it and learning about it more deeply. At uh-huh. least that's certainly been true for me. So I think, you know, when you're thinking about young people or even, you know, people in their 20s or people who are making kind of midlife career transitions, I think this notion, you know, that you should kind of find your calling or know what your calling is, which I think kind of causes a lot of people a lot of anxiety, is a little bit false. I think it's more about kind of trying out different things and feeling what resonates with you and also just sticking, you know, kind of sticking with things and allowing, you know, sort of meaning to unfold as you pursue things more deeply.
Jocelyn Glide joins us to talk about how to kill email anxiety, avoid distractions, and get real work done.